Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are definitely bundling up. I hope you have your wool socks on, because we are heading north.
Our north.
Far north, yeah.
Yeah.
We're looking at a stack of documents, journals, mission histories, some personal recollections that take us to a very specific time and place, Finland, in the 1970s.
And it is a fascinating setting to explore, because when you think of the 70s, you might think disco, bell bottoms, you know, all that. But in Finland, for these young missionaries, the reality was starkly different.
Right.
You've got the cold, dark sub-zero winters that just go on for months. And then there's the language, which, well, linguists say it's one of the hardest on earth for an English speaker to learn.
And culturally, you have this concept of sisu.
Right. Sisu doesn't translate perfectly, but it's this sort of stoic determination, grit, the ability to just keep going when you really should have given up an hour ago.
So we have this backdrop of just extreme difficulty. But the documents we're analyzing today, they aren't really about the weather or the geography. They're about a specific kind of mentorship. We're looking at how coincidence in these journals starts to look a lot like, well, choreography, and how the environment itself became what we're calling the master teacher.
That's the core theme, exactly. You see these young men, often greenies, which is the term they use for brand new missionaries.
Right, the new guys.
Yeah, the new guys being thrown into this intense crucible. And the sources show that they weren't just surviving, they were being shaped by these very specific, almost cinematic moments of mentorship.
And we have to start with the story that really defines this whole master-teacher idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's the account of Veli Sharman and his new companion, Veli Rasmussen. And just for clarity, before we jump in, Veli isn't a first name.
No, that's a good catch. Veli, it's pronounced Veli, is just Finnish for brother. It's the title they all use for each other, so you'll see that on everyone's name, and it kind of sets this tone of brotherhood right away.
Got it. So, take us to Oulu.
Oulu. It's pronounced Oulu.
Oulu.
Okay. It's way up north, almost at the Arctic Circle, and it is the very first day for Veli Rasmussen. He is completely fresh. He has no idea what he's doing, and he's paired with Veli Sharman, who is the seasoned mentor.
The veteran.
Exactly. They're standing in a park, and Sharman is basically giving him the orientation speech. Here's how we find people. Here's how hard it is. Here's the reality.
So he's setting the baseline, kind of lowering expectations to manage morale. Don't expect fireworks.
Exactly. He's just trying to be realistic, teaching him the ropes. And right in the middle of this speech, a car pulls up to the curb. And the source is very specific about this car. It's a long, dark green sedan with a Landau roof.
Which would stand out in 1970s Finland. That's not your typical Fiat.
It definitely does. So a middle-aged man gets out, walks straight up to them, and just says, "You have something for me."
Okay, now if I'm the experienced missionary, I'm probably thinking this is a setup, or a joke, or maybe even a confrontation.
But Sharman, to his credit, just follows his intuition. He reaches into his jacket, pulls out a copy of the Book of Mormon, holds it out, and the man says, "That's it."
That's almost too perfect. It sounds completely scripted. What's the context here? Who is this guy?
That's the kicker. The man explains that the night before, he had this incredibly vivid dream. In the dream, he saw two young men standing on this exact sidewalk in this exact park at this exact time, and he lives 150 kilometers away.
150 kilometers. That's a serious road trip.
He drove for hours purely on the strength of that dream because missionaries never came to his small town. He took the book, thanked them, got back in his green car, and just drove away.
Okay, so on the surface, that's a miracle story about finding a convert. But if we're looking at this through our master teacher lens, what is really happening here? Because the man just leaves.
That's the deeper insight. Veli Sharman reflects on this later. He looks over at his brand new companion, Rasmussen, and he realizes this wasn't just for the man in the car. This was for the boy on the sidewalk.
It anchored him.
Completely. I mean, imagine if your very first day on the job involved a literal miracle. Sharman actually worried that Rasmussen might think every day would be like this, that people just drive up asking for books.
Sure, that people just show up in fancy cars.
Right. But instead, it set this bedrock foundation of faith. It taught Rasmussen immediately that the work was real and that he was being watched over.
It really highlights Sharman's role as the mentor here, the master teacher. He didn't just high-five Rasmussen and say, "Cool." He contextualized it. He understood that this memory was going to be the fuel Rasmussen would need for the hard days.
Right.
Because, let's be honest, most days in Finland did not involve green cars and willing volunteers.
No. Most days involved struggling with grammar. And we have to talk about the language barrier, because this is where that resilience that Sisu really got tested.
I've heard Finnish is just brutal. It's not like picking up Spanish or French where you can guess half the words.
Not at all. It's agglutinative, meaning they stick words together to make new meanings. It has 15 noun cases. It's a nightmare for an English speaker. And you have these accounts of missionaries, maybe 3 or 4 months in, trying to debate complex theology.
Which brings us to the story of the gift of tongues. Or maybe we should call it the accusation of lying.
Yes, this is Veli Darwin Rasmussen, a different Rasmussen, and his companion Veli Sorensen. They've had maybe 5 months total exposure to the language, including their training. Linguistically, they're basically toddlers.
But they're in a home, and they're getting grilled by a couple who are trying to disprove the idea of modern prophets.
Right. The couple quotes this Bible verse that says, a husband should love his wife until prophets cease. They're using a sort of quirky translation to argue that prophets are temporary and therefore the missionaries are wrong. It's a semantic trap.
So how do two greenies get out of a semantic trap in a language they barely speak?
They use a metaphor. They basically say, look, if I tell my wife I'll love her until hell freezes over, that doesn't mean I'm waiting for a temperature drop in the underworld. It's a figure of speech for eternity.
That is surprisingly nuanced for someone with 5 months of vocabulary.
It was perfect. The couple actually conceded the point. But then the atmosphere changes in an instant. The husband stands up, points at the door, and throws them out.
Because he was offended by the hell comment.
No. Because he thought they were frauds. He uses the word valete.
Valete.
Valete. Exactly. It means you lie. He told them, no one can speak Finnish that well after only a few months. You must have been here for years pretending to be new to trick us.
That has to be the most validating rejection in history. Get out of my house. You're too fluent.
It's incredible. Usually getting kicked out is a low point, but these two walk away just beaming. The rejection proved they were accessing something beyond their natural skill. It was objective proof they were getting help.
It totally flips the script on failure. But I want to pivot, because not all rejections in these journals were, you know, funny misunderstandings or backhanded compliments. Some were genuinely dangerous.
True. We have to talk about Nantali and the story of Craig Peterson. This shifts the tone from intellectual resilience to physical danger.
This is the story with the stairs.
It is. Peterson and his companion, Veli Mike Nyborg, are doing what they call business tracting, going into shops and the apartments above them. And they decide to return to a building where a man had been really rude to them earlier.
Which already shows a bit of that Sisu. He was rude. Let's go back. Most of us would cross the street to avoid that guy.
Exactly. So they knock on the apartment door. It's the same man. He just loses it, starts screaming in a rage. Peterson doesn't understand every word, but he knows it's bad because his companion, who speaks better Finnish, refuses to translate it.
That's never a good sign when your translator just goes silent.
So they turn to leave. They're walking down the stairs, and the man rushes out, grabs Peterson by the back of his suit, and throws him down the flight of stairs.
This isn't just a shove. This is a full-on assault.
He hits the landing, totally dazed. He stands up, and the man comes down and throws him down the second flight of stairs. Peterson later joked he took a direct flight with two stops.
The humor is a defense mechanism, for sure. But in that moment, lying at the bottom of the stairs, uninjured, which he credits to guardian angels, what's the lesson? This feels like trauma, not a classroom.
The lesson is forgiveness. And this is where the master teacher moves from external miracles to internal character building. Peterson says he felt this distinct, immediate clarity that he had to forgive this man, not later, not after an apology, right then.
That seems incredibly difficult for a 20-year-old. I mean, if someone throws me down a flight of stairs, my first thought is not forgiveness.
It is difficult, but there's a coda to the story. Weeks later, Peterson sees the man in a grocery store. The man is terrified, probably expecting retaliation or the police. Peterson just smiles and waves. He describes feeling light with forgiveness.
So the mission field was a laboratory. In one case, you learn faith from a green car. In another, you learn forgiveness from a flight of stairs. It just forces this rapid maturation.
Precisely. It's about converting the missionary as much as the locals. And sometimes, the lesson was about patience and the long game. We see this so clearly in the logistics of the mission, specifically the nightmare of finding housing.
The Nokia story.
Nokia. This is December 1970. Val Boehme and Jim Erickson. They're opening a new city. They're commuting an hour by bus, missing curfew. And this is not a metaphor. They are literally sleeping in a bomb shelter.
A literal bomb shelter.
Cold, concrete, grim. They are desperate for an apartment. They find one owned by the Hautakangas family. It's pronounced Hautakangas.
Okay.
But they're number 12 on the waiting list. They have literally zero statistical chance of getting this place.
So they do the spiritual work.
Fasting, prayer.
They mobilize everyone, other missionaries, family back home. The deadline arrives. They go to the landlord. And it turns out all 11 people ahead of them dropped out. No shows, unreturned calls. The list just evaporated.
And the family, the Hautakangas family, is just baffled by this.
Marta Hautakangas actually told them later that she felt they must be close to God because of how the obstacles just vanished. So they get the apartment. But here's the insight. Why did that happen? Was it just so two American kids didn't have to sleep in a bunker?
I'm guessing there's a bigger picture. The choreography again.
The apartment was a Trojan horse. The master teacher didn't really care about the missionaries' comfort. The miracle was designed to put them in the path of the landlords. Because they lived there, the Hautakangas family observed them, they saw their dedication, and eventually they took the lessons.
And they joined the church. Kalevi Hautakangas didn't just join, he became a bishop, then a stake president. He led the church in that whole region for years. And Val Boehme realized years later, sitting in a conference in Salt Lake City, that the bomb shelter and the impossible waiting list were just mechanisms to get them to that one specific family.
It completely reframes the struggle. When you're in the bomb shelter, it feels like abandonment. When you look back, it looks like placement.
Coincidence is choreography, just like we said at the top. And we see this again in Nantali with the guided contact. Two missionaries, Craig Peterson and Greg Black, walk into a town of 7,000 people. I mean, where do you even start?
Right.
They follow an intuition to a specific neighborhood, knock on a door, and a woman answers who says, "I have been praying for someone to talk to my husband."
Because the husband wouldn't listen to her.
Exactly. She needed an external voice.
Yeah.
The missionaries arrived at the exact moment the prayer was active. It just challenges the whole idea of random chance.
I want to touch on one last dimension of this master-teacher concept. We've talked about external miracles and physical resilience, but some of the hardest lessons are about, you know, checking your own ego.
You're thinking of Reed Finlay and the Christmas package.
I am. This one hits home because it's so petty, but so relatable.
It's his first Christmas in Mickley. He gets a package from home, which is gold. Cookies, letters, warmth. He leaves it on a windowsill outside a grocery store for just a few minutes while he runs inside. He comes back and it's gone.
And his reaction is immediate rage.
Intense anger. He judges the entire town. Who steals a missionary's Christmas? He is just stewing in it. But then he realizes he can't do his work while holding on to that kind of judgment. So he goes home, gets on his knees, and he fights through it until he forgives the unknown thief.
He forgives the thief before he knows the truth.
That's the key sequence, because 2 days later he goes back to the store. The cashier pulls the package out from under the counter. She had seen it on the windowsill, thought it might get stolen, and brought it inside to keep it safe.
So it wasn't stolen. It was safe the whole time.
Finlay says he felt very small. The lesson wasn't about the package. The lesson was about his own assumptions. The master teacher used a simple misunderstanding to expose a flaw in his character, his willingness to immediately judge his neighbors.
If the package hadn't disappeared, he never would have done the work to forgive.
Exactly. And when you look at all these stories, the green car, the stairs, the apartment list, the package, you start to see the pattern. The mission wasn't just a service they performed. It was a curriculum they lived.
It brings up a really interesting question about the ripple effect of these interactions. We have one final example from Jay Wiseman that illustrates this perfectly.
Yeah. Wiseman meets two American students traveling in Finland. Initially, it's just a casual chat. You know, they just want to speak English. But the conversation pivots to the meaning of life. These students were searching.
And they get baptized.
They do. But then you zoom out. Wiseman notes that because of that one chance meeting on a street corner, those students went home and converted their families. Their children grew up to serve missions. The lineage of faith that just exploded from that one conversation is massive.
Wiseman calls it absolutely led by the Spirit.
It's that choreography again. Wiseman thought he was just being friendly. The students thought they were practicing English, but the outcome was generational.
You know, I want to circle back to Villi Sharman for a moment, because when we talk about the master teacher, he embodies it so well in that first story. He wasn't just a companion. He was a guide who helped Rasmussen decode the experience.
That's a crucial point. Rasmussen carried that green car moment with him for the rest of his mission, and honestly, probably the rest of his life. It taught him that he was part of something bigger, and Sharman's role was to help him see it. That's true mentorship, not just teaching someone a job, but teaching them how to see the world.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the Finland Chronicles, what's the takeaway for the listener who isn't standing on a frozen street corner in Oulu?
I think it's about recognition. These missionaries had journals where they recorded these things, which let them look back and connect the dots. They could see how the struggle led to the miracle.
We often miss our own green car moments because we're too focused on how cold it is outside.
Or we're too angry about the lost package. The invitation here is to look at the coincidences in your own life. The job you didn't get that led to the one you did. The person you bumped into. The delay that made you late but kept you safe.
If you look at those moments closely, do you see random noise? Or do you see a master teacher?
And maybe even more importantly, who are you the green car for? Who's waiting for you to show up just to anchor their faith without you even knowing it?
That is a powerful thought to end on. Thanks for bundling up and heading north with us today.
My pleasure.
We'll catch you on the next deep dive.